I am going to introduce you right now, Brian. Real excited to have you here. And you can take it away from here. I just, like, you know, before we get started, or you can lead with this, is can you explain your position, how you got there with the Saginaw Spirit, and so how you got there and what your position is?
Sure. My background is actually the business side of sport. Went to University of Windsor for my kinesiology degree and did a master's in sport management. So really cut my teeth on the business side. I was worked for a year or did a year long co-op with the advertising sales department with the Red Wings. So really on the sponsorship and the business side. And then it was kind of serendipitous. I had one of the owners from Saginaw reach out to me because the team was moving from North Bay to Saginaw. And so I was one of the first hires on the business team up in Saginaw. And we had 4 months to build the franchise. And that's kind of, I cut my teeth for, you know, the most of the next decade. I had a chance to work for my hometown team after that with Sarnia. I was vice president of business operations with the Sting from 2012 to 2015. And then when they had the ownership change, I thought, you know what, I need a change. And I kind of stepped back. And one of the crucial things, and as you were telling your story there, I was thinking to myself, is just how small the hockey world is. And, you know, it's just how you and I know one another through Dalton. And, you know, we got throwing names back and forth, and we know several people in common, and that's how it worked out. So building your network is crucial. I don't care if you're a player or if you're in the business side or you're at any capacity in hockey. Build your business, always be open to meeting other people and trading ideas. Don't be scared to meet and interact with people and share ideas. And then at that point, I was done in Sarnia, and I had a good friend of mine, Dave Drinkle is his name. He was the assistant general manager up in Barrie at the time, and he got the general manager job with Saginaw in 2015. And he called me up and said, listen, him and I had enough hockey conversations. I was a hockey nut. I know I was on the business side, but I lived and breathed hockey. And him and I had enough late night conversations about hockey that we knew we saw a lot of things similar, and we weren't scared to challenge one another either. So it is a little different. One of the things, when he started in Saginaw, he kind of wanted to put the flag in the ground and said, we are a US-based team. We need some type of US talent on our team. And that was one of the first steps. And him and I kind of laid out the path there. And I was in charge. I was brought in basically to help evaluate and recruit, US players. And, not that we want exclusively US players, because we're looking for the best hockey players, period, and the best people, period. But being a Michigan-based team, we just thought it was important to have that, not local per se, but just, U.S. flavor to our team. And that's kind of why I was brought in. And in our first year, we went about doing that. I guess hopefully that answers your question of kind of, you know, my background wasn't specifically the hockey side, but I was a student of the game and involved, watched more hockey than I can remember over those, 10 years of being on the business side, obviously watching every OHL game that I was at or when I worked for them, but also getting out to the OHL Cup, or getting out to Silver Stick and on my own and just going out and getting to know the players for the following year. So that's kind of my journey of how I ended up in Saginaw.
That's interesting. So because I always said, a lot of guys ask me to scout, and it's just something that I'm not interested in because I'm so busy, because I understand the commitment it takes to scout. Because I mean, at your level, I might even be tougher than at the NHL level, because you've got so many kids that you're looking at from all over the place. and to narrow that down to 300 kids or 400 kids and say, okay, these are the kids that I like, that's a tough job. So scouting itself is an incredibly tough job. And so I would like to ask you, so as you started getting into scouting, how did you have a knack for it right away, or was it kind of difficult to?
Well, I consider myself a lifetime learner. And as I said, even when I was on the business side, I would go up to the OHL Cup. I'd go down. I remember when Dan Halliburton was the head scout of Saginaw. If he was in Saginaw, I'd go on a trip with him. I remember going watching Bobby Ryan play with Detroit Honeybaked at that time. Or, you know, it's I would get out and watch hockey, and I enjoyed that aspect. I enjoyed the challenge of you know, not just, you know, challenging myself to learn, you know, to learn what to look for, but you got to train your senses too. And really, you know, my gift, if, you know, it's important whether you're, in any walk of life to be able to self-evaluate you know, one of the things that I knew I was good at just from my business background was building relationships. And I think that is a big job of a scout. It's not just about going and sitting in the corner. A lot of people have this false sense that it's about going and sitting in the corner and freezing your butt off and just watching games. And that there is a aspect to that. You know, you got to have the long underwear on, and you got to get into the community rinks. But it also is about building your network and getting to know people, because at the end of the day, for me, how I see scouting and the draft, to me, it's a battle to get more information than the next person on every player in the draft. And that's, to me, that's the only way to really dig down and not just understand what your team might be looking for, but understand, you know, what type of, not just player, but what type of person, what type of background, what type of human you're trying to you know, add to your team the following year.
Yeah, so that's actually leads right into the next question I was going to ask you, because obviously as a scout and as a manager of a team, you're looking for the absolute best player that you can get, but also the best player that fits on your team and to make your team better. So how do you, you need a good player, you need, and then you have to do the background checks. And how important is that combination of finding the best player, one that fits on your team, and finding a kid, and or maybe it's even a family that fits which what your team is all about?
A big thing is having your organization. You need a good leader. That make sure that each of the segments of the team work together. Because at the end of the day, that's going to determine success. The coach has a unique challenge, and I had a great conversation with him last week. Actually, there is not many people that could be a head coach in the OHL. And it does take, a certain strength to be able to manage just all those balls in the air and keep kids motivated. But just that type of communication, it's good to understand what your coach is trying to do. And, you know, we obviously have our stable of scouts. It's a lot of times they won't have direct access to the coach or the coaching staff, because the coaches work with the team, either in Saginaw or on the road and grinding for, you know, development, grinding for results. And the scouts are, you know, scattered throughout Ontario and United States watching minor hockey games. So the crucial thing is making sure that your leader, and in our case, it's Dave Drinkle, the general manager, is able to, he talks with Chris every day. And for him to be able to understand, and those two to be on the same page for the, just what we're trying, how we're trying to play, players that fit within our system, even going specifically regarding position, what fits into our team as defense, what fits into our team Like what aspects do we need? And for the general manager to be able to then facilitate that to the scouts, whether it's at our when we have our conference calls, when we have our, usually we have a big meeting at Silver Stick, and then again at a tournament, whether it's up in Peterborough or at the OMHA's weekend, and then another one kind of at OHL Cup, but for him to facilitate down to the scouts, because everybody has their own understanding of what makes a good hockey player and what they like. But at the end of the day, it does matter what you like, but what overrides that is really what are the coach and the general manager trying to do, and what systems are we trying to play, and what players then plug in into that system best. I think really one of the gold standards, or a couple gold standards in our league is you know, there's no arguing with the success that the Hunters have up in London. They do a very good job up in London, and do a good job of communicating to their scouts what type of players they want. But going back a few years in Sault Ste. Marie, when Kyle Dubas and Sheldon Keefe arrived on the scene, you know, they were really, it was so obvious the culture that they changed and the style that they completely changed how Sault Ste. Marie played and what they were looking for. And even what they were drafting, there were very good hockey players that you knew in hindsight and talking to them that they would have never drafted because it didn't fit into what they were trying to do. And, you know, I guess my point is you just need to facilitate that from the top of your organization all the way down to the bottom, because, you know, bringing in a specific player might be a really good player, but just doesn't fit into what you're trying to do from an offensive or a defensive standpoint, right? So just understanding what your organization is trying to do and what your coaches are trying to do is crucial for success.
Yeah, so before going to the next question, when you're looking at a player and you see someone, okay, I identified this person as someone that fits our mold of a player. Is it from there that you start going deep into the family life and the background checks? Or because I'm assuming, like, well, I would think that you're doing a lot of due diligence in that area, and that can maybe make or break it for a player. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Every year you know, there are just some indications or some flags that pop up with certain players that, you know, I hate the label bad kid. I don't necessarily believe that, but if one of the challenges with here in Saginaw is, for the most part, it's not hometown. We do have a hometown kid on the team, Mitchell Smith, this year, but for the most part, they're from out of town, whether it's down in Michigan. We have a Pennsylvania kid. We have, you know, a lot of Ontario kids. And so they're away from home, and a lot of times they're 3 or 4 hours away from home. So if you're going to bring them that far away from home, and you can't be with them 24/7, so you do have to have some type of just character in their background and understand that they're mature enough that they're going to make good decisions. They're focused on their development and themselves as hockey players and as people, and they're going to do their schoolwork. I handle the high school as well. They're going to do their schoolwork. You know, even when they're on the road, they're going to show up on time. They're going to follow the rules. And it's just some young men are more prepared to do that than others. And especially at 16 years old. So again, I hate the label bad kid, because I just some are mentally more prepared to handle that at 16 and 17, and some will get there, but they won't get there till they're 19 or 20, right? So it's understanding what what young men are, are mentally prepared or mature enough to be able to handle those challenges. Because as you know, that first year in the OHL is, or junior hockey in general, it is a challenge when you're going up against guys that are 2 and 3 and 4 years older than you, and you're maybe not getting the ice time or special teams that you're used to, or you're not even in the lineup on a day-to-day basis. And it takes a special kind of player to just be mentally mature enough to not be happy with it, you know, those challenges, but just to understand that, to learn the grind. I guess at that point you're learning the grind. You're learning the grind, and again, you're not going to be happy with the grind right away, but it's part of the process, and you've got to learn to accept that it's part of getting better, part of development, and it's not going to stop. This is kind of the first year of it, maybe, that a player has seen, but it's not going to stop throughout their career if they truly want to make hockey their vocation or give their best shot, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things I try to instill in the kid, every kid that I teach. And, you know, and if parents ask the questions or want to listen, that's one of the things I try to impart on them, is to understand that this is not an easy job. Like, this is not an easy business. And your heart will be broken, everybody, because everyone thinks that they're just good enough to get there and don't really understand the commitment that it takes. But so as a family, if you had a 15-year-old son that was getting drafted, or even younger than that, as a dad or a hockey dad guy, how would you go about, if I don't know if you can answer this question, but how would you go about preparing him mentally, physically, to encourage him to get to his dream? If you can come up with something there.
If I could boil it down, and you and I have had some conversations, and you know, I think it's great to have parents supporting. That's the only way young people are going to be able to really, you know, they need help setting their goals and setting their dreams, and really kind of, you know, learning in their teenage years. But I think one of the things a lot of parents, a good lesson would be, they need to teach their young person, I don't care if it's a boy or girl, I don't care what sport, is to advocate for themselves. You know, there's a lot of times where you'll and I'm sure you see this at the minor hockey level, where it's always the parents doing the talking. It's always the parents asking the question of, well, what's happening? With this? And I understand that young people might have a challenge, and young teenagers have a challenge with that, but to have them talk to the coach and have them advocate for themselves, have them talk to their teachers, you know, even if you're there to support them in the meeting, I think that's great, but have them do the talking. And it's painful as a parent. I'm not a parent myself. I'm a VIP uncle. I've been in the business long enough that I can even see when we're sitting with families, and you know, if the young man is answering the question, I know that maybe the parent's thinking to themselves, I might have answered it a different way, or I might have said it a different way, or but that's part of the learning process, is for that player or that young person to find their voice and to advocate for themselves and to be able to ask questions and develop those communication skills. Because it's going to serve them well, not just in their hockey career, but in life, life is a challenge, and hockey, you know, hockey is it's a sport, it's to have fun, but for the ones that want to be serious about it, it's not if your heart's going to get broken or you're going to face adversity or you're going to be a healthy scratch for no reason, and you're not going to get a good reason for it other than maybe it's a numbers game or something like that. Like, you need to be able to advocate for yourself and communicate with the coaching staff. Do you see that at all in kind of the, in your day-to-day and interactions with hockey players?
It's incredible, to be honest with you. I mean, I see it all the time. I gave an example. Like, so actually what you said is something that's been repeatedly said on my webinars. Okay. With like Ian Pulver said the exact same thing. And which is always, it's always good to hear it more than once, because, you know, one time it might just be words, but to hear it 2-3 times, it becomes very important. And I think it's absolutely critical. And it's, you know, I always have to go back, because the closest person to me is my son, and he plays hockey, right? He's a 14-year-old boy. And we had a situation. So I apologize to the listeners that have heard this story before, but I'm going to say it again. So it was 2 years ago. He was playing, and he grew up as a D, because it's a funny story why he grew up as a D, because like Dalton and Ekblad were all right-handed D. Ryan Ellison, these are all guys that I worked with. Sure. And he heard as a little kid, he heard that being a right-hand D is hard to find. And he's a right-hand shot. So right away, when he had his little curly blonde hair, wanted to be a D. I want to be a D in the NHL, right-hand D. So anyways, he was a D up until Pee Wee, and the coach, because he's got some offensive, he's pretty somewhat gifted, right? So he had the coach in Pee Wee, I believe it was, asked if he could be a forward. So he came home and he was just torn. He goes, Dad, he said, it's up to me. So he goes, I have my reasons why I don't want to be a defenseman anymore. No, they moved him forward, and then he moved him back. He wanted him to go back to D because they needed help on D. So he goes, but I have my reasons. I said, well, let's hear them. So he's sitting there and he had tears in his eyes. He goes, Dad, I worked so hard this summer to become a forward. I worked on my shot, on my stick handling, and all those little things. So these are my reasons that I want to be stay at forward. And I feel like I'm around the puck more, and I feel that's more like my game. I said, okay, so we'll talk to the coach. And I said, we'll go in there. So, and you're going to do the talking though. So he went in there, and there was four adults, and I was nervous for him, but I was so proud of him. So he said his points, he was tearing up, and the coaches looked at him and said, you know what, Charlie, those are great reasons, and we'll keep you as a forward. So he felt a lot better from it. So like, I agree 100% with that, is let them have a voice, and they're not going to say everything perfect all the time, but it gives them, just like I was telling you earlier about just doing the technical side of this, if I don't do that, I don't get better. Yeah. So the communication piece is huge. And then at some point you have to have that confidence, or face the fear of going to talk to a coach or speak to a coach that you feel like you have a point to make, and you just want to understand, and you don't want to keep that inside. You want to be able to communicate. And especially in today's day and age, people are much more understanding than when I played in 1980, in the 80s. You know, we didn't have a voice, but now it's a much better place to be. So I encourage kids to do that, and I encourage parents, exactly what you said, let them advocate for themselves as much as they can.
Sure. You know? And I know just from internally, like, our coaches' doors are always open, and it is a different day and age, and you know, there are better communicators. There's getting to be better communicators in the coaching positions, and you know, knowledge of the game is just one aspect of it. If you can't communicate it, or if you're threatened when one of your players asks you questions or challenges you on a certain strategy, you know, you need to be able to have a mature conversation and yes, communicate about it, not you know, just yell and scream. So
yeah.
I know our coaching staff's doors are always open, and it's a unique challenge. You have 22 individuals in the locker room. Everyone's a little different, and you're trying to manage that, and you're trying to look for signs to see if, you know, one player might be struggling. And that's, I think parents need to be empathetic of that too, that a coach is trying to manage a lot of different players, and, you know, it's sometimes they might miss things, and it doesn't mean they don't care. It doesn't mean they don't. That's why communication is so important, and a player's ability to maybe communicate with a coach and you know, make them aware of something they might not know, right? So right. a certain challenge. or you know, and not just on the ice, but off the ice as well. You know, there's more challenges off the ice than there is on the ice. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I have a question for you as far as the hockey goes on, but then I do want to talk about like on the ice, off the ice, body language, how they present themselves and stuff like this. Cause I want the parents and the kids to come out with this and say, okay, what I would like to play in the OHL or wherever I want to play. And I want a scout to notice me. So here's a, I'm going to load this up for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. As a scout, I'm assuming because I'm not a good scout. If you watch a hockey game and you see the offensive player that sticks out like a sore thumb, like, wow, that guy, every shift he's doing something offensively, I'm assuming that's fairly easy to scout. Maybe on a more difficult side, you're looking for, let's say you've got a third line guy that just, finishes his checks, got the clean exits out as a D or a forward, not so noticeable. How do you scout that? Or I'm going to go back a little bit here. What about that offensive guy? You see the offense. Is it good enough? Or do you see he just lacks so much over here, I don't think I can fix it. And then included with that, just to load this up big time, is playing on a good team that important? Or does it make them blend in too much? Or do you notice them anyways? Can you see who the best guys are and why they're the best? And then conversely, playing on a poor team, does that hurt you? So if you can remember any of that, I'll give you
You know what? We'll have to step back and unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
But I guess the first question, really was just what you asked, that, the best guys are probably, relatively easy to see and to scout. Yes. When,
right.
The skilled, the best players are pretty easy to see. When I saw Cole Perfetti play for Vaughan in his minor, right. Actually, I saw him as a major bantam playing up with Whitby.
Right.
It was obvious he was the most, at least on our board, the most skilled player. And when I went and saw Bobby Ryan 25 years ago, or yep. No, I guess 20 years ago, but that one was fairly obvious. The best players do jump out, but they're few and far between. Most of us were never like that, or have a hard time relating to that. That's a unique situation. So you kind of flowed that into, what are you looking for? And everybody might be looking for something a little different, but I'll boil it down to this. The game has become so skilled anymore. It's funny, if you take, I remember when Jimmy DeVellano, senior vice president with the Red Wings, bought into our team. He's one of the minority owners of our team. He was living up in Toronto, and he joined our head scout for a few games to watch. It was Jack Hughes this year. So he went and watched the Marlies play. I don't remember who they were watching. Ian Mahar was our head scout at the time. He's the assistant GM in Hamilton now. But Jimmy D came back, and he just couldn't believe the skill level of minor midget hockey because he hadn't seen a game in forever. And even at the, when you take a step up from there, like junior hockey and OHL being, the pinnacle of that, the skill level of the young athletes is really beyond what you and I could have dreamed of. I think, 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah. No, it is. I've seen it evolve over the last 20 years myself.
Yes. And I am getting to a point here, so you'll have to bear with me.
Yep. No.
The skill level has got to the point where if you give players time at the OHL level, they will pick you apart. So overall, the general overall. So really, how do you counter that is you have to be tenacious in your puck pursuit. And that can go back to minor midget, as far as players being tenacious on the puck and working hard and players that have good motors and are tracking properly, not just tracking for effort wise, but tracking properly on the back check. you know, that is a big part of, and that's something that players can control, is just their work ethic and their motor. And it is noticeable as a scout. If you keep noticing a player out there that's always stripping pucks or always tough on the puck or always putting pressure on the opposing D, you know, and creating turnovers, you know, it's that's noticeable. And that simply goes back to, and it's a combination of things like brains and skating. And there are skills involved in that. But just when you boil it down, the work ethic and the desire to do that, you know, that's a big thing, you know, I think that is noticeable. That's if you keep seeing that over and over again, and those are skills, you know, that might be less noticeable and not everybody is necessarily looking for it. But to me, that's a big thing that players themselves can control. You know, you can work on your skating and your edge work, you know, by working with people such as yourself. You can work on your shot just by doing, you know, shooting 500 pucks a day or a couple hundred pucks a day. You know, you can work on things like that, but work ethic is a switch. You can turn that on and you can turn that on right now. It truly is a mental decision, and to train yourself. And that doesn't always mean going 100 miles an hour when you're out there. You do have to think the game. It's, you know, if you F1 and F2, if you're F3, you don't want to rush in and create pressure for pressure's sake. And then the puck gets behind you. And yeah, you were tenacious. And yeah, but, you know, it was great. You know, you showed good work ethic, but it wasn't the right decision. So I guess there is a combination there, and that maybe evolves into the kind of the next thing you're looking for is just players that understand the game and have not just an intuitive nature about the game and a, you know, hockey sense is kind of a key word right now. It's a hot button word right now, but just understanding what that means for a defenseman, what that means for a forward, centerman, or winger, and really, you know, finding players that really are students of the game and understand the game, right?
Right. I've got, I'm going to ask another question with that, though, but we've got a kid on my son's team. I'm not going to name him here, but he, honest to goodness, might be the best forechecker I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give you his name after because, like very, very, very impressive how hard this kid works. Like, it's phenomenal. You know, I told that to my son. I said, you know, whether, and I'm not saying this as a judgment or not, I'm just saying that whether he's the best player or he's not the best player, his work ethic is off the charts, and it's inspiring because it gets the team going. I mean, it's phenomenal. You know, finish a check, and yeah. So someone like that, you'll take a look, you'll say, wow, that's what we're looking for. Then you kind of piece together, okay, he's got oatmeal north of the eyebrows, or he actually has a brain, right? And then you decide as a scout, okay, like, I think we could do something with that, or we'll give him the opportunity, or we don't, right?
Yeah, if you're 30 feet away and the D-man's facing you with his head up, you know, it doesn't – pressure isn't at least at the next level. It's not about pressure.
Right.
Because you're not going to get there in time. He's got his head up. He sees everything.
Right.
It's more about understanding what aspect you're trying to take away from him and angling and using, you know, and using your brain that way. Right. So there is that fine line between effort for effort's sake and directed effort. Right. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and that's a big part of it but effort will get you noticed. You've watched enough hockey. You watch enough hockey. You know, if you want to get noticed, for the good, effort. You know, after that, it's up to you to show, you know, they'll but when you get their attention, they're gonna look at the other aspects of your game. But if it's simply about I want to get noticed, effort.
Yeah.
That's noticeable. I guess that's the easy way to get easiest way to get noticed, and it's totally under the player's control. So, you know, after that, you're going to have their attention. So they're going to look at the other aspects of the game, both strengths and weaknesses, because everybody has weaknesses.
Yes.
I don't care if you're, I don't care if you're, you and I have both seen exceptional status players come in, Aaron Ekblad, Stamkos, John Tavares. You know, there was weaknesses in their game.
Absolutely. You know?
So, absolutely. Or things they needed to work on.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I remember when John Tavares came into the league, the big talk was his skating. Well, you know what he did? He went and got the best skating coach in the world, and he worked all summer on his edges in that. And once he joined the NHL, after his first year in the NHL, that was after he was in the NHL too.
Yeah.
He worked on his skating. Well, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years, or since that his rookie year, you hadn't heard a lot about his skating challenges. That was never – I hadn't heard about it anyway.
No, and you don't see it as a hockey observer. You don't see it.
No. And I think the crown jewel of that might be Sidney Crosby. And I know we're talking about, elite level players, but the point – understand the point. The point is even they are evaluating their own game, and it's so crucial to have an honest evaluation of your own game. That's another thing that a player can control is understanding their own game and be honest with yourself. You know when you played a good game, you know when you played a bad game or when you had a good shift or a challenging shift and but you got to be honest with yourself too and not be scared to be honest with yourself. You know, it's, and from a parent standpoint is help your son or daughter, evaluate their own game, don't just tell them how great they played, but just, I like how, when you sat your son down, it was about him telling you, not about you telling him.
Absolutely.
About why he should stay forward.
Absolutely.
It's about asking questions and getting them to be able to get the wheels moving and then be able to, put the sentences together and communicate that, right? So, because believe me, from a coaching standpoint too, like, again, going back, and I know I'm on a bit of a tangent here, but going back, being able to communicate with your specific coach, whether it's a D coach or whether it's a forward coach and you're doing video, you need to be able to articulate your questions. What should I have done here? Was this right? Yeah. Was this, what are you seeing here? I don't think this was the right play for me. And having an honest dialogue back and forth again, I said advocate for yourself earlier, but at the end of the day, when you boil it down, it's about communication skills. And
right.
But I guess I've on a bit of a tangent here, Andy.
No, it's all good. It's all good. To add to that, I was talking to, so last night I helped out my son's team, run a practice. So it was good. And then I love these kids. I mean, honestly, we've got 18 kids on this team, and typically you get a team and you get a couple kids, you're like, yeah, I don't care for this kid. This team is unbelievable. 18 beautiful, hardworking, nice, respectable kids. It's a dream team. And the parents as well, they're just great parents. So it's very enjoyable. That's why I enjoy helping them when I can. So I was talking to them last night about about this thing. I have this thing that I talk to kids about, and it's more from a mental aspect of it, like in between shifts, just to do to reprogram yourself and just forget about the past, forget about the future, just stay in the moment. And what I tell them is that you should all have 4 to 6 things, but let's say five things that they feel makes them a good hockey player. So like, cause not everybody can be a goal scorer. Not everybody can be, whatever. So what are 5 things? And I try to do things like, winning a face-off, like you said, tracking back hard, the little things, you get a 5 things, and if you get 2 or 3 done every shift, you're having a good game. But it gives you a chance to reevaluate, okay, this is what I'm good at. Okay, I got these 3 things done that shift. That was a good shift, and it keeps your confidence at a high. So maybe one of the things people can do is actually talk to someone that they value their opinion, and not worry about the goals, not worry about that kind of stuff, but worry more, no, be concerned more with those little things that make you a good player. So that's way with a lot of players too.
Absolutely. If
you don't, parents can help with that. They can help direct their kids as well.
Yeah. If you don't understand yourself as a player and what you are, then you're going to have a hard time getting better and identifying things that you need to get better at. Right. So, yeah, that's definitely an
interesting part.
And I guess to build on, you know, I guess as a scout, when we're in a rink, you know, you asked me, how do you get people's attention? And we talked a little bit about that, but just, you know, be careful when you do get, there are negative ways to get a scout's attention as well. And that's,
yes,
you know, if you're going down the wing and you shoot a puck and you shoot it high over the net and you throw your head back and, you know, try to show everybody in the arena that you're not happy that you missed. Well, everybody in the arena knows that you weren't trying to shoot it over the net, and have some confidence in yourself that you're going to get another chance. You know, that wasn't your one and only chance during the game. Just keep playing. Or if they're going off the ice, and believe me, we watch the benches. We're either sitting behind the benches or across from the benches, and you're watching players as they go off. You're watching, especially one of the big things as scouts is we're going to see you play a lot. You know, it's every night there's going to be somebody there watching you, and that's not to put pressure on. But my point is, just because everybody has off nights. Just because you have an off night or an off shift, it's not the end of the world. Any scout worth their weight in salt is going to see. They're going to be a grinder themselves. They're going to be out to the rinks and watching your regular season games and watching you night after night after night. You know, at least they're going to see you play anywhere between a dozen and a couple dozen times throughout a year, right? So,
yeah,
and
that's just
the area person. So I guess get noticed for the positives, but just be careful of getting noticed for the negatives, because we are looking for that as well, you know, and it's not to write players off, but it does go into our notes, and it is maybe a question we'll ask your coach or ask yourself directly as a player. We'll ask players about you know that. So there are positive ways to get noticed, there are negative ways to get noticed, and you need to understand the difference.
Yeah, I love that you touched on that, because something that I talk to the kids a lot about, like constantly, is that you're walking around this earth, and as a hockey player, this is what you choose to do. There's someone watching you, whether you want to have them watching you or not. And that could be walking through the rink, and that could be going to the corner store, it could be anything. People are watching you and judging you, so you got to do act appropriately. You know, when bad things happen, it's how you respond to it, not, reacting in the manner that you were saying with your slugging your shoulders and showing bad body language, bad attitude. I have a question about the defensive. Let's say a defensive player. How the heck do you have an eye for someone like that? What came to my mind when I was thinking about this last night was Chris Phillips. You obviously know who Chris Phillips is, played for Ottawa. Okay, so he was a first overall pick or second overall pick. But how – there is nothing fancy about that game. It's just – so how does someone like that – that has that type of game, like how, even if it's a parent, because I think a lot of people want to see their kids score goals. How do you even evaluate that? Because I can't.
Well, I wasn't around when Chris Phillips was scouted, so I can't necessarily speak specifically to him. But I know where you're coming from with that question.
Yeah.
You know, number one is. Just understanding understanding the skills of a defenseman. And, you know, fans and a lot of parents want to look at points. They want to look at maybe power play time and that. But anymore, and it depends on what systems you're playing anymore as well. And you know, as a big defenseman right now, Chris Phillips might not be first overall if the draft was done again today in today's game. You know, with the rule changes and the way it's changed, you know, you look at, you know, I was actually in Buffalo watching Dahlin play, and, you know, special player, top defenseman, obviously taken that year, and top player taken that year. But just as defenseman anymore, it's not about points, but you need mobility anymore. Sure. And being able to move as a defenseman, and that's the real challenge. It's not about, and I'm sure you know you work with my cousin Dalton down there, and Dalton's a big, strong, you know, quote unquote, stay at home defenseman. You know, plays tough if he needs to, but the big thing for him now, he had to kind of change, I'm sure, how he was training and that, because it wasn't how big and strong you were. It wasn't about carrying 245 pounds and being as strong as you can. No, it was about trimming weight and being 230 or somewhere in that range, and having more mobility, just because the game is getting so fast and that. So, you know, and I love scouting defensemen. That's the aspect I really enjoy, and I love getting down at the glass and seeing how a defenseman makes decisions under pressure anymore, because that's at the next level. Yes. You're always going to be under pressure. And so the other thing I said was mobility. It's you can still be a stay-at-home defenseman. I hate that term. I guess I want to take that back. You can still be a big, strong defenseman. But depending on the system that you're playing in, you do have to have a lot of mobility. You do have to, you can't just hang back and let your gaps get out of control. You have to gap up and gap up quick, because if you let the forwards, a lot of times you got to play defense before they get going. And even, you know, the last few years, the big thing was defending forward, right? You know, closing that gap in the neutral zone, angling them out, and kind of snuffing the play out before it starts. Yeah. And so I guess in that respect, this kind of a stay-at-home defenseman in this day and age, as you move up, it's the traditional sense of a stay-at-home defenseman maybe is dead, but you can be a big, strong defenseman. But you have to be mobile. You have to have a good brain. You have to be able to make decisions under pressure. And this is an underutilized aspect of it, is a lot of times for a defenseman, it's just make the easy play. Make the 5 foot pass. You know, it's not necessarily about outskating anybody or you know, feathering an 80-foot stretch pass up the middle and that. Honestly, sometimes it's literally a 5 foot pass to the bumper or the nipple, depending on what you call it, and just making the breakout as easy as possible. It's amazing the number of players that just won't make the simple play.
Yeah, it's a very frustrating thing. I am so glad I asked that question, because I use Chris Phillips as an example because that's what came to my head. I probably should use a more modern day player, but you are so bang on with that, with the defensive player. Like, you could still be defensive and you could still be that hard guy to play against, but you have to have much more mobility now. And then as a defenseman, I think actually any player is the simpler that you keep the game, the better. And I preach that to every team I've ever coached and players that I coach, is that, you know, like Ryan Ellis was a great defenseman, but he saw three layers ahead of him. Like, and that's a very special player. But also by doing so, he would make three phenomenal plays that no one saw, but he also turned over the puck quite a bit, but he was able to recover from that. So it was encouraging for me, from you talking about that, is I just got educated a little bit there to continue to do what I do with defensemen, because that's what I try to do is, you know, you can't do enough puck recoveries and retrievals and footwork and just quick, you know, quick hands coming, you know, quick passes coming off your hands, creating deception when you do things like that. And the more that the kids practice that, even the shooting, right, it's getting it off quick so they can get tip-ins and stuff. And so I'm really glad that you answered that question and you took your time and you put the effort into it. Thank you.
Well, I'm trying to be somewhat general as well, because honestly, when you don't want to predetermine things with the player either. You want to, right. You know, there's not a scientific formula for what makes a good defenseman or what makes at least you try not to be too scientific. There might be certain aspects you're looking for, but a modern day example would be Seth Jones off of Columbus, a big, strong, high pick. I think he's probably 6'5 or 6'6. So there is, you can be big in play, but just look at how mobile he is. He's an athlete and he was a high pick. And I know he was traded from Nashville to Columbus for Johansson there, because Nashville at the time needed a number one centerman, and Columbus needed some defensive depth, and usually you can't trade for a D-man like that. So I guess that would be a modern day example of there is room for a big player in the league. It's just the idea of what a big player is has changed, and what the big player needs to be able to do.
For sure. Brian, so I'm going to ask you two more things. Take your time. Do whatever you want to do. First thing is that we talked about playing on a really good team or a poor team. So my question was that, with that would be kind of geared to the parents as well. Like, a lot of people think that playing on a good team, a super team, is more beneficial than playing on a poor team. You guys still notice them, right? Or do you not? Is it tougher on a poor team?
We have area scouts, and the area scouts are responsible to scout all the teams in the league and identify players. It's, when we're making our selection on draft day, it's not necessarily, there's very little conversation. In fact, if it does come up, it's more like, well, this player didn't play on a great team, but we like the way he handled this. We like the way he did this. I don't think it's necessarily, to me, you tell me who the coaches are and the type of coaching they're going to get, and I'll give my opinion on what team they should play on. To me, it would be, I think you're asking, a parent would be asking the wrong question. Is it a good team or is it a bad team? It's tell me about the coaches and the history of that coach and the type of practice they run. And because at the end of the day, it is nice and to win but there's not a lot of teams necessarily. You can't, it is a team game after all. And you can't control that. So, I don't personally think, if you look at our fifth round pick this year, Roberto Mancini, you know, didn't play on the best team last year in the GTHL, didn't make the OHL Cup, but we stepped up in the fifth round, came to camp, and he made our team, and he earned it.
Right.
And, you know, it's I don't want to tell parents what to do. It's not necessarily my job, but we as scouts, it would be part of the conversation of just what the overall team looks like. But we know that. We know when a team is good and when a team is bad. And that's, if you're on a good team, sometimes that's used against you too. If the team's too good and doesn't face any adversity throughout the year, you know, there's question marks that aren't answered there either. So, or if you're a really good team and you're not, they don't, you know, you as a player don't develop throughout the year because it's too easy, then what good is that? That's, you know, yeah, you get some ribbons and some trophies, but, you know, at the minor hockey level, you do have to develop, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great answer. That's kind of what I thought too. So before we go, cause I know you're a busy guy, it's scouting season. You probably got reports to do. we're going to talk about the Saginaw Spirit, because I was honest with you when I talked to you about this, and I'm always just going to be honest. I said, if you were to take my son and it's Erie, Flint, or Saginaw Spirit, and you're looking at my son, I would have some concerns being an American market, you know, the school and everything. How do you overcome that? Because I've been to Saginaw and I've been to all these places, and I think they're great organizations, but how do you overcome that? Because I'm sure that's a question that you get from people.
Well, a big thing is getting people to town and just informing them. I do handle the schooling, as I said earlier, for our team. And our players go to a bricks and mortar school. It's Heritage High School. It's an IB accredited school. And we have a education consultant that's a math teacher right at the school. So I'm actually going to go over and see her this afternoon, because we have a study hall this afternoon, because our team was on the road this weekend and we missed a couple days of school late last week. So we have a study hall. So having her right at the school, that's an advantage. I know that's, I guess I don't want to speak for the other teams, but I'm sure she interacts with the players on a daily basis. And can you hear me? Can you still hear me? Well, I'll keep talking, but anyways, having the education consultant right at the school is integral. And,
yeah, you know, but yeah, the internet can start to go.
I can't hear you, but so I guess having the education consultant right at the school, that's a big part of it. And then, the idea is that the players graduate from their home school, and at the end of the year, you know, transferring back to their home school and graduating from their home school. So our education consultant talks to the home school advisor or the home school academic advisor, they work it out so that the classes that they take here in Saginaw transfer back and they get credit for at their home school. And and at the end of the year, they graduate. So, all right, are you back?
I'm back. Unbelievable.
I don't know where we left
text off. You. Are we? I don't know. We were talking about education.
Okay, I'll start again.
Yeah, sure.
We actually all our players go to a bricks and mortar school, Heritage High School. It's an IB accredited high school here in Saginaw. And we actually, our education consultant is a math teacher right at the school. And every team, I don't exactly know the specifics how every team does it, but every team has to have an academic advisor or does have an academic advisor. And it is advantageous for ours to be a math teacher right at the school. She interacts with our players on a daily basis. In fact, I'm going to catch up with her name's Pam. I'm going to catch up with Pam and our players this afternoon, because we're actually having a study hall, because our team was on the road. We had a long road trip at the end of last week and they missed a couple days of school. So we're going to catch up and hopefully get them back on track there. But the idea is that we want to work with whatever the home high school is. So, you know, we'll use your son as an example. You know, is it St. Anne's or whatever high school in Windsor?
He goes to Essex right now, but yeah, St. Anne's popular with a lot of kids.
Goes to Essex. Our education consultant and the counselors at Heritage would reach out, touch base with your home school counselor. They would coordinate a plan for the year, so what classes they're going to take in first semester, and that will transfer back home in second semester. The idea is line it up so that When our season is done, they can walk right into the school back in Essex and kind of pick up where they left off. We do, for most kids, it's a combination of bricks and mortar classes and online from the home high school or from Heritage that transfer back easily, just because that's what the home high school wants. We work with the home high school and making sure that the player is academically eligible to graduate from their home high school. And it is, there's not a cookie cutter approach. We handle each player individually because it depends on what the home high school wants them to do as well. So the goal at the end of the day is for them to graduate from their home school. And unless there's a good reason for they, you know, in years past, I know Brendan Saad ended up and Vince Trocek ended up staying. I think our season went so long that they decided to stay and finish the year and graduate from Heritage High School. But, you know, it really is a customized plan. And, you know, we do work with the homeschool. The nice thing in this day and age is with the technology that exists and is as advanced as a lot of the schools are, you know, you can make it work. So, you know, and at the end of the day, that's for most OHL, just because of the demands of the schedule and you are out of town, you know, an online option to help supplement your bricks and mortar classes usually comes into effect.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was this is phenomenal today. I actually probably need about 2-3 hours to go through everything with you because it's been great. And maybe at some point in the future we could come up with a few more topics and questions and do it again if you'd ever be interested in that.
Anytime. It's hard to, you know, there isn't a cookie cutter approach away. Everybody's journey is different. I think that's important to understand. And you know, just because, you know, you face some adversity and face some challenges, you know, last weekend or with, you know, in your current season, you know, you can either, you know, use that to discourage you or you can use that to stoke the fire and use it in a positive sense. I'm not asking, you know, I wouldn't ask people to be happy with the adversity, but understand what it is and how it can be used in a positive way. So that would be the big
thing. Yeah, that would go with being drafted as well, right? Like being drafted is always a special thing for every player. Where you get drafted is a great thing. But just because you're not drafted or you're a 10th round pick doesn't mean that you don't have a chance either, right? It's just a different type of adversity.
Yeah, and understand that the general manager and the scouts are the ones that make the picks. But at the end of the day, the head coach is the one that puts, you know, says who goes on the ice. And when he's standing behind the players and looking down at the names on the back or the numbers, there's no draft position. Honestly, the coaches have a job to do. And that is to, you know, it's kind of twofold. It is obviously it's process driven and development. But where the rubber meets the road, you do need to win some games. So the coach is going to put players on the ice that are going to win their games. Look at our captain Damian Drew was a third round pick. Nobody cares. Our assistant captain and one of the heart and soul players on our team, DJ Buzdecker, he was undrafted. He was a free agent and coach doesn't care. Coach doesn't care. No. You know, it's just one day and it's something to be proud of. It can be a show of the hard work, but the fact you didn't get drafted, you know, at the end of the day, we'll still be watching next year and looking for free agents and looking for the midget draft. Look at Anthony Cirelli. Sorelli, you know, he's playing with Tampa, probably going to play a big role now that Stamkos is hurt, but he was undrafted in our league. Like that's a lot of very good hockey people missed on that. And you know, to his credit, he put the work in and has earned everything he's got. But you think the Tampa coach looks down and says, "Oh, he wasn't a first round pick in the OHL. I better not put him on the ice." Yeah. No, he doesn't care. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because that's even, you know, all the NHL guys that I train, I go, "Oh, hey, this guy got drafted." They don't know who the draft picks are. Like, I mean, they might have heard whatever, and they don't care because, like you said, till you're fighting in the trenches with us and stuff, or it matters. Like, they don't even know who you are until you get there. So yeah, getting drafted is one thing, and it's just a grind. And if you want to stay there, it's even more of a grind, right?
Yeah, it's something to be proud of, but keep it in perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to determine your ice time.
No, 100%. Okay, Brian, I can't thank you enough. I appreciate it, and I'll follow up with you. And this was a fantastic webinar. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll do this again sometime.